Here is what you need to know about today. Trump turns to Putin for help.
Why?
We're going to explain. The video of the incineration of 150 or so young schoolgirls has been released, and there's plenty to say about it. And Mr. Trump brags and laughs about killing Iranians. How's that going to go over in the Middle East, especially with some of the allies? I'm going to ask that of a leading Saudi commentator here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. So glad that you're here with us. So Donald Trump has a problem right now, and you can always tell what Donald Trump's problems are because it's always the opposite of what he says, right? And because he has a problem, you know who he just turned to? Vladimir Putin, of all people, to help him try and solve the problem. So let's talk about the problem. The problem, as I just said, is always the opposite of what he says. So he says Iran is desperate right now. He says Iran's entire government has fallen apart. He says all the people in Iran have turned against their government or are turning against their government. He says the Iranians want to negotiate. They're calling me. They want to start talking again. Now, ask yourself, is there any truth to any of that? Nah, not really. Not really. Now, does Iran want to negotiate with Mr. Trump? That's a good question. Here's the guy, Aranchi, that I met with recently when I was in Iran, and he was just asked the same question. Do you want to negotiate with the Americans? Are you going to sit down and negotiate with Mr. Trump? Here's what he said.
I don't think the question of talking with Americans or negotiation with Americans once again would be on the table, because you know we have a very bitter experience of talking with Americans after three rounds of negotiation, and after the American team in the negotiation said itself that we made a big progress. Still, they decided to attack us. So I don't think, you know, talking with Americans anymore would be, on our agenda anymore.
You really have to ask yourself, right? And I guess you have to admit, why would Iran or anybody want to negotiate with an administration that just assassinated the very people that they were negotiating with? They killed them in the middle of the negotiations. It's obvious that Iran and much of the world doesn't trust Mr. Trump. You know who they do trust, though? And this could probably sound a little weird to you, right? If you're watching from, like, the UK or the United States, where the vast majority of the viewers of this show are on social media, and you probably would think just the opposite. But you know who people trust, especially around the world and in this part of the world? They trust a guy named Vladimir Putin. They trust President Putin. Yeah. And apparently, Trump now knows that because he just reached out to Putin, apparently last night, and they had a one-hour-long conversation, I think mostly about Iran.
I had a very good call with President Putin. We had a lot of people on the line from our side, from his side. We were talking about Ukraine, which is just a never-ending fight. And there's tremendous hatred between President Putin and President Zelensky. They can't seem to get it together. But I think it was a positive call on that subject. And we obviously talked then about the Middle East. And he wants to be helpful. I said, you could be more helpful by getting the Ukraine-Russia war over with. That would be more helpful. But we had a very good talk, and he wants to be very constructive. Yeah.
Donald Trump has called Vladimir Putin to discuss a number of critical issues related to current developments in the international situation. The focus naturally was on the situation surrounding the conflict with Iran and the ongoing trilateral negotiations on Ukrainian settlement with the participation of U.S. representatives. The Russian president expressed a number of considerations aimed at a speedy political and diplomatic resolution of the Iranian conflict, including in light of his contacts with the leaders of the Persian Gulf states, Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian, and the leaders of several other countries.
You know, if you listen, go back to listening to Trump, it almost makes it sound like, first of all, he didn't want to be asked that question. He wanted to just get rid of it. And he also makes it sound like he doesn't need Putin, right? I don't need that guy. That he makes it also sound like Putin needs him because Putin has bigger problems. That's kind of not true. I mean, Putin is winning his war with NATO, the one where Ukraine is being used as a proxy. That's pretty clear. And by the way, the economy of Russia is not being severely affected by that war as it was intended to. In fact, the economy of Russia has been growing of late. Now, the same cannot be said about the economy of the United States or even the U.S. military situation. And that's, we're talking about something like this, where the war has already affected the economy and the military situation and the geopolitics of the United States, and it's not even the second week of the war. Now, let's talk about something else. As for assertions that Putin is worried about the instability of the global oil market, actually, let's, you know, do the math here. Russia's better off with an unstable global oil market because that makes Russia's oil more valuable. I checked on this myself this morning. I looked at the numbers recently, and Russia's oil stocks, all of them, are through the roof. We put a little visual for you here. Gazprom, it's one of the top energy companies in all of Russia. Just over the last month, look at that. That's GAZP, you see right there. The stock is trading up 7% over that time period. The other one is called Rosneft. That's Russia's other top energy company amongst all of these that are here. It's up 22% over just the last 30 days. That's a big number for a company with a market cap of $57 billion. You see, those are numbers that a lot of U.S. companies would love to see right now. But this attack on Iran at the behest of Israel is actually hurting a lot of U.S. businesses. And Iran knows that, by the way. And they know that to deal with that, what they've done is they've devised kind of a fascinating media strategy. I don't know if you've noticed what Iran is doing, but in the past, countries like this would just be tight-lipped and avoid conversation, especially with reporters from the other country. Avoid the foreign press, for example. But you know what they're doing? Yeah, they're avoiding the foreign press, but they're talking to U.S. reporters, including their favorite useful idiots. Sorry. NBC News.
Are you afraid of a U.S. invasion in your country?
No, we are waiting for them.
You are waiting for the U.S. military to invade the ground troops?
Yes, because we are confident that we can confront them, and that would be a big disaster for them.
It's almost like this young reporter, God bless him, he's a Cuban kid from Miami, good for him. But, like, he has no idea outside of the U.S. borders what's going on in the world. He is so surprised that a country would be talking this way about the United States. It's almost like it's funny. He looks like he's 20 years old, and his opinions sound like they're 60 years old. Something else about Iran that you should probably know about that I've been watching. They're also very visible on social media these days. And I think they've been pretty smart about this. They're playing videos. I'm going to show you one of them. They're playing videos that play to the Global South audience, right? The audience that this kid you just watched working for NBC News has no idea they even exist. He doesn't even know what the Global South is, right? But he's playing to these countries, people who live in places like India and China, South Africa, Brazil, et cetera. These are people who live in countries that already hate the West, right? Because of the previous wars, because of the previous attacks on so many Muslim countries. So watch this video. See, that kind of stuff is probably effective, right? And we've never seen, you know, we didn't see Iraq do that or Libya do that or, you know, any of the other countries in the past that have been in these tussles with the United States and the West do that. It's kind of like a new era, I think, you know. It's a new period for people to use media and use it kind of as a defense against the West, which is usually the one that does these great. Because where are these things usually made? Hollywood, right? Who's been great at convincing people of the opposite? The United States. But you know who's even better than the United States? Israel. Of course. I mean, they're the masters of playing, maybe better said, owning the media. They have been doing this for decades with a lot of money, a lot of control, a lot of access. And by canceling anybody who disagrees with them, by just saying, that guy over there or that lady over there, she's an anti-Semite.
A lot of this is done with money.
Invested billions and billions of dollars in the information battlefield.
Money of NGOs, vast. Money of governments, vaster.
We prohibit harmful stereotypes about Jewish people, such as claims that Jews control financial, political, or media institutions.
You're damn right we're going to cancel them and deplatform them.
We monitor them online, social media, messaging apps, video games, cryptocurrency.
Hitler admirers, Stalin admirers, Jew haters.
Podcasts, short-form video, Wikipedia, LLM.
American haters, Churchill haters.
We monitor these people and we share the intelligence with the FBI.
You think your stupid little podcast is going to change the world like hell it is?
Social media, this is the new battlefield.
You know who they're talking about, by the way, when they say you, me, Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, anybody who's giving you a different version that they want people to hear. Now, I want to show you something else. I want to show you what the media in the United States doesn't show people who live in the United States. They just released a video of the actual missile strike when these young girls were killed in this school. It's horrible, right? I mean, the video has been released, and it's now official that it was a U.S. missile that actually killed these young girls. And Scott Ritter was on here yesterday, and he took us through an explanation of actually what happened, why they didn't stop with one missile, why they did a double tap and hit it with a second missile. And as you're listening to Scott, we're going to superimpose some of the video of the actual attack. So here it is.
Our brilliant weapons designers have concluded that the excess fuel in a Tomahawk missile at the moment of impact can actually be weaponized into a thermobaric weapon, a fuel-air explosive. Oh. And so they hit the button, turned the excess fuel into a thermobaric, and the people they saw running were the children who survived the initial attack. They went to the prayer hall with their teachers, and they asked the parents to come in and retrieve their children. Parents were on their way. So the movement you saw were survivors going into the building, teachers with them, parents come to them, and we put the fourth cruise missile in there, turned it into a thermobaric bomb, and burned these children alive. That's this war in a nutshell.
Yeah.
We don't know what we're doing. We don't know what we're targeting. And all we're doing is murdering people. And you know why this happened? Because Pete Hegseth canceled a Department of Defense directive that required a civilian mitigation team to go over each target to make sure that we weren't striking the wrong targets. He called that woke. He called that ineffective. He wanted to be the most lethal fighting force in the world. Kill, kill, kill. Well, Pete, you killed him. 170 of them, children. You're a murderer. You're a war criminal. And so is Donald Trump. And so is every American who supports this war. Because this war is an illegal war of aggression. We aren't obeying the laws of war. And we're simply slaughtering innocent people to appease a bunch of neoconservatives who have an outdated concept of what the world should look like and who have completely subordinated the interests of the United States to the state of Israel. And I apologize for losing my temper.
I'm a
father of two girls, and I would hunt down and kill anybody who brought harm to my children.
By the way, you may agree with Scott Ritter, you may disagree with Scott Ritter, but Scott Ritter's opinion should be heard. Are Americans seeing Scott Ritter? Is he being interviewed? No, not in America. Are Americans being shown that video that was just released of what really happened when those little girls were killed, incinerated, as he said? No. For the most part, it's not being shown. They're moving on to the next story. So instead, when they move on to a next story, what do they do? What kind of stories are you going to see in America right now? A bevy of stories, obviously, about America's enemies as chosen by, I guess, the State Department? China, Russia, they're bad, they'll tell you. You want to see a perfect example of this? I found something this morning that just made me crazy, so I wanted to share it with you. Do you remember the Havana syndrome thing, the Havana syndrome? It was a story about Russians using some secret outer space beam-like thing to lock into people's brains. Even the CIA and the Pentagon said this was bull crap, said it wasn't true. Well, here's CBS. By the way, a company owned by Israel, one of the biggest networks in the United States, especially for old people, they're still hell-bent on convincing people of this story and talking about this story to create the anti, or continue, the anti-Russia narrative. Watch.
60 Minutes has learned details of a classified microwave weapon that may explain mysterious brain injuries suffered by U.S. officials. We've been investigating these injuries for 9 years, and now our sources tell us this microwave weapon is portable, concealable, and uses relatively little power. Hundreds of possible attacks have been reported, including, we've learned, at CIA headquarters in Virginia, and at least two incidents on the grounds of the White House.
Oh, sorry, is he done? Yeah. This is a newscast that's seen mostly by 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds in the United States, but it doesn't matter, right? The fact that they can't let it go is crazy. But there is a change. There's a change taking place right now in America. 60 Minutes, the show that you just watched this guy who's falling asleep reading was doing, it used to be watched like by 50 million Americans. It was one of the top news shows in the world. I remember they once called me and were thinking about hiring me, and I was like, oh, my God. You know, you call your mom, Mom, 60 Minutes wants to hire me. They want to make me their first Hispanic correspondent. I was so excited. But that's not the case anymore. By the way, so they used to have like 50 million people, sometimes 100 million people who would watch them, especially if it was fit around the Super Bowl. Do you know how many people are watching this show today? How many people watch 60 Minutes today? About 5 million a week. 5 million in a country of, what, 350? And by the way, you know who gets almost four times the size of that audience? We do, right here, this show. This show gets, on an average week, about 20 million viewers here. 20 million viewers that we're getting. And you know who has a bigger audience than we do? Good for them. Tucker Carlson has a much bigger audience than I do. So does Megan Candace Owens. So does Megyn Kelly. These are broadcasters who, by the way, supported Mr. Trump. And they were all in on MAGA. But now they're against his policies, right? And, who's the face? Who's the face of Mr. Trump's new policies that Tucker Carlson's against, Candace Owens is against, and a lot of these people are against? Lindsey Graham, a man who lately, I don't know if you've seen this guy on TV, he sounds like he's possessed with like a bloodlust for Muslims and others. Watch.
They're going to lose and we're going to win. All Israel right, and the United States, you just wait to see what comes in the next 2 weeks.
The next 2 weeks meaning what?
We're going to blow the hell out of these people. I'm not looking for a fair fight. If we get in a fight, I want to win it. I want to win it quick. I'm in Miami. You see this hat? Free Cuba. Stay tuned. Yeah. The liberation of Cuba is upon us. It's just a matter of time now. You see this hat? Make Iran great. President Trump said the only way to make Iran great is for the people to take over. We're marching through the world. We're cleaning out the bad guys.
It's like a clown show. But after watching Lindsey Graham, who, by the way, has very close ties to Netanyahu, to Ben-Gavir, and to Smotrich, who also, just as casually as this guy, loved to talk about killing Muslims, there are those in the United States who are now telling President Trump, that guy's crazy. Stop listening to him. Stop listening to Lindsey Graham. You know who's saying this? Here's Megyn Kelly, for example. Take a listen.
This guy is a homicidal maniac with a bloodlust that is insatiable. He wants us, he got us into the Iranian war, Lindsey Graham. Now he wants us to get involved in a Lebanese war, which is Israel's already starting or involved in. And he wants us to go into Cuba, from the sound of it. Possibly, is that a boots on the ground situation? I don't know. But this guy should be nowhere near President Trump. He should be, not be allowed within 20 feet of the president's orbit. And the president should make the decision to keep this guy the hell away from him, or at least in his own mind, shut down his influence. This is not a force for good in the United States of America, Lindsey Graham.
And while we're on the subject of Megans, or people whose first names are Megan, let's talk about John McCain's daughter. John McCain and Lindsey Graham were like this, besties, right? Before John McCain died. Here's his, John McCain's daughter, Meghan McCain.
I've known Lindsey Graham since I was a child. I'm imploring anyone who will listen in the Trump administration to stop sending this man out as a surrogate. He's scaring people and doing damage to whatever message you're trying to sell to the American public about the Iran war.
So now that I've kind of tried to set the table for you, as we do every day on what's happening on any given day, given this latest situation with Iran, what about America's allies? You know, they see this playing out, and what are they thinking? You know, people who are the friends of America and places and countries, for example, in the Persian Gulf, look what they're going through right now based on their friendship with Israel and the United States, whatever that is. Their economies are tied to the United States, but their people generally can't stand what the United States has done to them and to others over the past 40 years, wars, attacks, support for Israel. And Trump is falling right in line with all of those actions. Some would say even worse. So what do you do if, for example, you're an official in Saudi Arabia? Perfect example of what I'm talking about. You know, it's one of those conflictive moments for many of these countries. And I want to ask that question to one of the most recognized voices in all of Saudi Arabia when it comes to geopolitics. Salman Ansari is a very high-profile commentator and researcher. I've watched his stuff. He's good. He's a really easy guy to talk to, and he's really smart. And he gets the region, you know? Thank you so much, sir, for joining us. It's so kind of you to take time to talk to us.
Thank you so much, Eric. I'm so glad to be with you.
Likewise. Oh. Let me start with this. I want to play something for you. I saw this today and I went, I kind of wanted to cringe. I don't know how you're going to react. Here's President Trump, just within the past 24 hours, talking about the dead Iranians on a ship that's 2,000 miles away. And by the way, it had almost little or nothing to do with what's actually going on in the Gulf. They were on a mission helping the Indian Navy. But here's Mr. Trump talking about using a submarine to blow this ship and kill all the soldiers. Watch. Or sailors.
I don't want to brag, but, you know, they've said this about a lot of things. No other president could do some of this shit I'm doing. Yeah. Iran's drone and missile capability is being utterly demolished. The Navy is gone. It's all lying at the bottom of the ocean. 46 ships. Can you believe it? In fact, I got a little upset with our people. I said, what quality of ship? Excellent, sir. Top of the line. I said, why did we just capture the ship? We could have used it. Why did we sink them? They said, it's more fun to sink them. I said, that's a... They like sinking them better. They say it's safer to sink them. I guess it's probably true.
Those are dead human beings. The way I was raised by my parents, it doesn't matter if they're Muslim or black or white or tall or short. Those are dead human beings. You don't laugh at people... And you don't minimize deaths like that. It just, it's tough to watch. I'm just sitting here watching you. How do you defend that? More importantly, how does that play with, for example, the citizens, the people who live in Saudi Arabia?
Hello, Eric. Yeah, I think it's a multifaceted thing. We can't just be having a white and black kind of description of what's going on. But yeah. We have to actually unpack two boxes here.
Okay.
There is one box, which is U.S.-Israel war against Iran. Okay? We should put it in its place. Mm-hmm. And the second box is Iran targeting Gulf countries. Mm-hmm. So who would have, for example, imagined that Tehran would target Oman, for example, Oman, which is actually the closest GCC country to Iran. And it's the country that played a key role in mediating between Tehran and Washington. And who would have actually imagined that roughly half of these Iranian strikes would target the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, which is Iran's second largest trading partner after China.
Yeah.
And the UAE is also the country that is considered to be the major Iranian IRGC financial networks hub, according to the U.S. Treasury Department. So we are seeing some very counterproductive Iranian behavior in the region that
what else could they do to defend themselves? I mean, here's what the Iranians have told me when I've talked to them. They've said, well, they're hitting us, and they're hitting us while they have installations in these countries. So we have to hit these countries. It's the only way we can defend ourselves. And some would argue it's kind of working for them. Some would argue they're kind of winning this war because they're demolishing some of that U.S. infrastructure that's being used to attack them. That's their story. How do you argue with that?
Yeah, actually, all these countries that I've mentioned, we're actually speaking of 12 countries that have been targeted by Iran.
Yeah.
So there's no justification for them to attack them at all, because all these countries have actually committed to not allow the U.S. To use their airspace, land, sea to attack Iran. So this is actually very important to mention for your audience, that our issue with Iran is that they are proving that the American story is correct. So instead of Iran trying to have a fair game where they actually respect the countries that actually commit to not target them, they actually went on the opposite side. So we saw how the president of Iran, Pezeshkian, he actually apologized to the Gulf countries. And he said, this is unintended, et cetera, and we should not do it again. And guess what? Just 5 hours later, around 5 to 6 attacks on Saudi Arabia happened from Iran. So we are speaking, yes, at that moment, it was like a headless Iran. So right now, we can actually see how things are, and we have a new assessment.
But do you believe? Go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry. Well, let me ask you this. Do you believe the United States when they say they're not using these installations or territories to attack?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
I've got a bridge to sell you then, because I guarantee you they're using the satellite systems. How do you think that they're able to use their anti-defense missile system to stop these Iranian missiles? They're using some of those satellites that's in your country and other countries, no?
Amazing. So we should actually, are you suggesting, Eric, that we should actually forget about our Patriot systems and the defense, so we can actually allow Iran to hit us? That doesn't make sense. But I want to actually to be very clear with something important.
No, this is a good conversation, by the way, and I'm glad that you were being very clear about it. And please, I apologize for interrupting you. I didn't mean to. Go ahead, finish.
No worries at all. Actually, we agree on the first box, so that's why I actually wanted to differentiate between the box, the first box, which is U.S.-Israel war on Iran, and the other box, which is Iran targeting these 12 countries. And among them are countries that are very close to Iran. So it just doesn't make sense, and it won't. And there's no justification for them at all whatsoever, because I believe that what they are doing is on the hope that they will be targeting the backbone of the global energy economy, so the prices can go up. So Western countries have their people to be pressuring their government to stop this war. Maybe that's actually one of the major reasons and justifications for the Iranians to do it. So that's why they actually apologized, even though that apology did not hold merit, because they actually continued to have this war. But with regards to the first box, which is the U.S.-Israel war against Iran, the Saudis have been very clear. Yes, there are some countries, like they were actually drumming for the war, but on the media field, like the UAE, but they officially declare that they are actually against the war. But the Saudis have been very consistent, and they said it clearly, that this war can actually have more repercussions on the region. And the Saudis have also warned and told the U.S. that the Saudis have warned the U.S. before about Afghanistan, about going to war on Iraq, etc. Unfortunately, we still have the consequences of these wars until now. So I'm afraid that Washington seems to be saying, I learned a lot from my mistakes, so I decided to make more mistakes to learn more. So so that's actually concerning, to be honest.
But yeah, I would imagine.
At the same time, that does not give any justification for the Iranian regime to do what they have been doing. So
if what else would they do? Let me ask you.
Allies of Iran, they should actually pressure them. And I think China and Russia are pressuring Iran, to be honest, to not harm their relationship with their neighbors, because that actually proves the American point that Iran is a global state of terrorism, and it's actually a destabilizing force in the region.
But let me ask you just a like a basic question that a 10-year-old would ask. If I'm being attacked and I have no other recourse to attack my enemy other than to hit his resources, which are happen to be in what I consider to be my backyard, what else am I going to do? What else could Iran have done to punish the United States for punishing them?
Yeah.
I don't
it's
know.
It's actually what interesting else? Because, yeah, I see your point. But the idea that you have I would call it the green light to target 12 countries just to punish the global economy so you can punish the United States, that shows that this behavior is very counterproductive, and it will get the countries to be in the same page with the United States to fight you. And that's why the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia recently launched this statement, and they actually stated it clearly that the Iran will be the biggest loser if they continue on targeting our infrastructure and oil refineries, etc. Up till now, we are receiving some drones targeting refineries. And we've seen how the kingdom actually, this is something that people didn't speak about. The kingdom actually executed one of the most sophisticated emergency oil supply responses ever. And I mean it, ever. Yet almost no one is talking about it. When as you know, when the oil jumped to 117, many assumed Saudi oil exports were trapped. They were wrong. Three things happened very quickly by Riyadh. First, Saudi oil already stored in countries like Japan, Korea, and other countries in Europe, etc., were released immediately. Second, exports were redirected through the Red Sea instead of the Gulf, through the east-west petrol line. Mm-hmm. And the third is that Saudi Arabia signaled to markets that supply was available. So the system worked, and prices fell because Saudi Arabia was ready. It fell from 117 to 85 within 24 hours. So Saudi Arabia is a responsible country that wanted to stabilize the energy markets, where Iran is actually intensifying their attacks on refineries, on oil installations, on hotels in the GCC, on Bahrain, in Kuwait. So I can't give them any justification for that. If you are having an issue with Israel and the U.S., do something about it and show that you are actually capable of fighting back, but do not fight your neighbors just because your neighbors are actually allies and partners with the United States.
Point taken. And with the exception of 1977, there's no country in the world that has been better at regulating the global oil prices than Saudi Arabia through OPEC. Job well done, and point taken. Iran, to be fair, would say they're not hitting Saudi Arabia. In fact, they deny that they hit the Aramco refinery. I spoke to one of your colleagues recently who told me he thinks that came from Iraq and that it wasn't from Iran. And there are those who think that the Mossad is doing it because they want you to go to war with Iran. What's your comment on that? As this gets
honestly,
even more complicated.
It's nonsense.
It's
nonsense.
Okay.
And we've seen how the Iranian behavior has always been. They always, so that's why I call their political system to have this kind of schizophrenic illness, where they actually say something and they do the opposite. And they lie, and they know that we know that they lie. So the idea that they are diverting attention, it's not going to be productive.
Let me hit you with this. I love talking to you. I can't wait to come and see you, and we're going to hang out together, because it sounds to me like you're just a regular guy that I'm having a conversation with. So there's this theory that the reason countries like Syria, Iraq, Iran, and others get hit by the West is because they don't succumb. In other words, these are countries who say, no, we want to be neutral. We want independent. We're not going to play your games. We're not going to be like you. We're not going to do everything you want. But other countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and others that do, in the eyes of some people, succumb, they're left alone. What do you make of that argument? Actually, what do you make of that argument?
I said it earlier, Eric, that we committed that there will be no attacks at all whatsoever. So that's why you see Lindsey Graham is actually pushing Saudi Arabia and the UAE and the Gulf countries to go and join the war. And guess what? It may happen if the Iranians still escalate the war. So that's why we don't want this scenario. And there's something important, Eric, that people in the whole world should understand, specifically in the West, that there are very big repercussions that may happen very soon that will affect the lives of individuals, not only countries. So and we've seen how the past couple of days proves that what happens in the Gulf doesn't stay in the Gulf. And there are three major global repercussions the world faces: energy security, food security, and trade security. So the Saudi-led Gulf countries represent, as you know, the world's largest energy exporting hub. So people around the world would feel the high costs of energy when our part of the world is in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. Second, the Gulf is actually, this is something that has never been mentioned throughout this war. The Gulf is also the world's second largest exporter of urea fertilizer after Russia, meaning global food security is at stake as well. So it's not only oil. Third, about 20% of the global trade goes through the three strategic straits around the Gulf: Hormuz, Strait of Mandeb, and also the Suez Canal. What happens in the Gulf never stays in the Gulf. That is why it is crucial for the international community to remain engaged in protecting the stability of this region. Yes, the best scenario, the best thing we want is complete de-escalation, where the United States and Iran would have a common ground through which they sort out their differences. Definitely, we have a lot of grievances with Iran. Their support of militias, the Houthis, the Hezbollah, et cetera. So that's actually very concerning. At the same time, with their nuclear enrichment and their ballistic missile program, and we've seen how their behavior lately. So we have a lot of grievances, but at the same time, we believe in diplomacy more than anyone else. Yes, some people may see the whole situation to be concerning because it seems like Israel is the brain and the United States is the muscles. Yes, I can see that.
Yeah.
But I believe that there are different priorities. The Israelis would go for the maximalist, which is a complete regime change in Iran. I think in the U.S., within some circles, within the administration and the political fabric in the United States, they are actually more pragmatic and they are actually more realist. They would actually go along with the idea of having a complete, comprehensive agreement with the Iranian regime, even with its current supreme leader. I don't know if he is actually going to be there or not, because the United States actually signaled that they will be targeting him. But we should all hope for the United States and push for the United States to have this realist kind of deal. Yes, it will not be a perfect deal that will actually make the Iranian regime to get back its senses completely, but at least to lower the repercussions and the potential repercussions that will happen not only to the global economy, but also the global trade, global food security, and so many different things. So we just don't want this to escalate more. So I want people always to remember the Saudi position, that it differentiates between the two boxes.
Yeah.
The U.S.-Israel war against Iran, and the second box, which is the Iranian behavior against the Gulf. The moment we differentiate between them, we will give a constructive kind of argument through which we can see the situation as it is, rather than just putting the issue as if it's two camps.
So let me take you
black and white. So that's not actually, that's a reductionist thing to say.
So let me take you through your argument just for the sake of clarification. So what I take from you is you agree that it was wrong for Israel to attack Iran using, as you say, the muscle of the United States. It's wrong for Israel, for Iran to have been attacked. You agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I personally agree that this war should not have started to begin with. But that did not give any justification for the Iranian regime to wreak havoc in the region and to send up to 80% of their attacks against the GCC countries, not Israel. Actually, Israel just has been hit with 15% of the attacks. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
So
Well, it's hard to tell because Israel doesn't get a lot of information out of there. I do wonder, though, as I'm studying this and looking at, you know, how this has happened, what the relations between you and Iran are going to end up like and what they are, perhaps even right now. Last time I spoke to the foreign minister of Iran, he told me, he said, Rick, we have good relations with the Saudi officials. He said, I speak with the Saudi foreign minister all the time. We're in regular contact. Is that not true?
I believe the Saudis, after the Beijing mediation between Saudi Arabia and Iran in 2023, I believe.
Right.
Since then, things actually, the heat got lowered a lot, and the Saudi-Iranian relationship got to somehow, I would call it, a healthy direction. It wasn't like, not all their issues have been resolved, but a healthy direction. But unfortunately, after this war and what happened during the last week, actually, I would call the whole Beijing mediation is somehow on hold rather than it has been broken. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But to me, I would see it as a big violation of the sovereignty of the kingdom. Yes, the Iranians are trying to allow the Saudis to have this kind of face saving by saying it's not us, it's the Iraq, it's from Iraq, etc. But that doesn't make a lot of sense. And the Saudis should be applauded for their restraint and for their strategic patience and for their responsibility, not only for the region, but for the whole global economy and stability. So will Iran go back to its senses and through its new supreme leader and see the situation as it is and to appreciate the Saudis not joining the war and not allowing the U.S. to operate from Saudi? That's something we have to wait and see. So well, we are in the mode of let's wait and see rather than let's see and act.
They would probably say, it's not like we want to hit you. We just feel like you're on the wrong side. They would say, why don't you join us in the war? Why don't you hit our enemies who are attacking us? That's probably the argument they would. What if they made that argument to you? I mean, and they would argue, we're fellow Muslims, we're in the same region, you know, we've been together for so many years. It's time for countries in this part of the world to come together and allow and stop allowing other countries who are your neighbors to be hit. What if they argued that?
They actually won't argue that because they know our response will be for the last 50 years since 1979, we've been at the receiving end of Iranian terrorism, bloodshed, and destruction.
Yeah.
We've seen how they have been attacking the kingdom and the Gulf countries through their militias. We've seen how they were actually funding terrorist militias in the region. We've seen how they have been trying their best. Even in the Grand Mosque, they have had a group of Iranians wreaking havoc in there in like 30, 35 years ago. So I think Iran, we have a real issue with Iran that it does not want to live as a normal country.
Do you hate them more than Israel?
In their constitution, Eric, they're having the notion of exporting the revolution. So how can you deal with a country that actually its ultimate goal is to export its revolution, its Islamist revolution to all the countries around it. So it sounds like you have a whole world is wrong. You know what I mean?
It sounds like you have a visceral hate for the Iranians based on your description. Do you hate them more than you hate Israel?
This is a binary reductionist thing.
That's what I get paid to ask questions like this.
Yeah.
Think about it though. People are listening. They got 20 million people listening to us in this conversation, and they're wondering, what is Saudi Arabia's position on this? I mean, are you with Israel?
Overall, I'm an independent Saudi political analyst.
I know, which is why you're so good to talk to. I know.
Yeah. But that question, to answer it, first of all, I'm actually, I would say, 5 kilometers away from the Iranian embassy here in Riyadh. So we do have an Iranian embassy. We do have diplomatic relations, and we do not have diplomatic relations with Israel. So it's not a hate and love thing. We are speaking of principles. The Saudis have been trying its best to accommodate Iran and to not allow Iran to have any justification to wreak havoc. But whatever we do, they always go and activate their revolutionary kind of behavior to wreak havoc in the region. With regards to Israel, we don't have a relationship with Israel, and we won't have a relationship with Israel until they abide by the international law and after they allow the Palestinian families and children and men and women to have self-determination and to have dignity. Yeah. So that's actually a principled position and also a pragmatic position by Saudi Arabia. Yes, it's principled, humanitarian. It could actually be coming from the fact that they are Arabs and Muslims, etc. But that is not the only thing, but also a pragmatic reason in there, which is the fact that we cannot have a safe Middle East, like the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said when he said, I want to see the Middle East to be the new Europe. That cannot be achieved while having this hanging issue in the region. And we will not be shy on saying that Israel is one of the root causes of mayhem and destabilizing situation in the Middle East. It's the same we say about Iran.
Yeah, I've read your comments and I've read the statement from the kingdom, and generally, yes, it the rest of the world is saying that the nation of Israel has perpetrated a genocide against the Palestinian people. And it's hard to counter that argument. It's hard to counter that argument. And I've read your comments on this, and you've been very staunch on this. Let me ask you about Putin and Trump. Suddenly, I guess Trump picks up the phone, calls Putin last night. What do you think what do you think Trump is looking for in this conversation with Mr. Putin? And what value do you give to Putin as a negotiator in a situation like this, given that you have very healthy relations with Russia, as I know?
It's interesting you ask me this, because I'm the Saudi and you are the American, and you are asking me about America. So I would actually ask you that question.
But well, in Russia, right?
If you say Russia, then I would say I can actually say the same thing because you're in Moscow. Anyway, but with regards to Russia, I think Russia is a responsible country. We have some differences here and there, but that does not go against the fact that we have a very healthy relationship with President Putin and with Russia in general. And yes, it is concerning a little bit the fact that some people want to paint this Middle Eastern conflict as a conflict between the Eastern camp and the Western camp. We don't want it to be seen this way. We want it to be seen realistically. And we should actually name things by their names. We should not actually go and internationalize, how to say it, internationalize the issue in such a manner that would give us the same kind of vibe of the Soviet bloc, you know, in the past, and the Western world, etc. So that's one. Number two, I think Russia has very strong relationship with all the GCC countries, specifically Saudi Arabia. So I'm sure that they will not take any position that would go against the security and the well-being of these countries. So they will take a principled, balanced position. Yes, we understand that they consider Iran to be, I'm not going to say their ally, but I would say their friend. But we should actually encourage the Russians to use that to have the Iranians to do and to provide some compromises, not only to the region, but to the whole world with regards to the major grievances that everyone is having from Iran. On top of them is the nuclear aspect of things, because I believe that Moscow doesn't actually want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. You cannot actually entrust such a regime with a nuclear weapon at all whatsoever. The same goes with the militias. The same goes with the ballistic missiles program. Yes, we understand that the Iranians have this issue of mistrust in the world, because there were some missteps by the West, by the UK and the US at the time of 1953, et cetera, and the coup that happened against their prime minister. Exactly. So they had this kind of built up kind of idea of that caused them to be having this kind of paranoia of the West and that they will never be able to trust anyone. But I think right now, Iran is not in a good position to dictate its terms. It should actually go back to its senses and see any way to get out of this problem by emboldening or by, I would say, by encouraging and fostering their diplomatic channels with the United States and the Gulf to find a political solution that may actually anger Netanyahu and his regime. And there is this solution. It can actually happen because I believe this war will end on the terms of the United States and Iran rather than the terms of Netanyahu.
But wait a minute. The Iranians are saying, we've tried to negotiate. We've sat with them, and every time we try to negotiate, instead of negotiating, they bomb us. So how do you negotiate with somebody who bombs you in the middle of the negotiations, they would argue? How do you?
Yeah.
They have a point, don't they?
They can argue about that. And as I said, I don't agree with the war to begin with. But at the same time, we should not forget that the Iranians have always been priding themselves and about how they are actually skillful negotiators on just using time, etc. So we all knew that Iran was actually not really negotiating with sincerity because they just wanted to win time until President Trump is out of office because they saw him to be the actual obstacle for their hegemonic kind of project in the long run. But that's a speculation. You could actually argue that maybe yes, maybe not. It's hypothetical, etc. I agree.
Yeah, but it's a tough situation for them too. So I get it. But hey, I got to get you on the record on a couple of things since we're down to like 5 minutes. First of all, the Iranians say, "Oh, we're not looking for a nuclear weapon." That's what they say. We're not enriching more than 3.66 or whatever the number was that Mr. Arachi told me when I talked to him. But then he went on to say, or he didn't go on to say this, but other Iranians told me this. And there's a couple of CIA officials who are saying the same things. They're saying, "Well, Israel has nuclear weapons, and so does the Saudi kingdom." Is that true?
The Saudi doesn't have nuclear weapons. I don't know how they got that, but
Nixay, no.
Yeah, maybe they are referring to the Pakistan agreement deal between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, which says that we have the nuclear umbrella over Saudi Arabia that is provided by Pakistan. But with regards to Israel, definitely, and we've been actually speaking about this relentlessly in the UN, etc. And it's not something that we accept at all whatsoever. Yes, the Saudis have had multiple initiatives to have a Middle East free from nuclear weapons and all these kind of
And Saudi Arabia is a signatory to the moratorium on nuclear weapons in the Gulf states, to be fair. And I want our audience to know that, so it doesn't sound like the Saudis are out there trying to make a bomb or anything.
But no, not at all. And at the end of the day, like the Crown Prince actually said it earlier, that he said, we are in a position where nobody in the whole world is actually going to use such a weapon because the whole world will go against them. So we know that it's mostly like a deterrent kind of weapon. And the Saudis have only put one condition of them acquiring the nuclear bomb the moment Iran does. And so that's why we don't want this kind of escalation that is very counterproductive for the security of this region. And I just want to urge everyone to always look at the issue not from a zero-sum approach, but from a multifaceted approach, because that's very crucial. And I would also urge our Russian friends to encourage their Iranian friends to be somehow their new guarantors. Let's not forget, President Putin has a good relationship with President Trump. Yes, they have differences.
Yes, he does.
But they can actually leverage that.
They can talk on the phone. Yeah.
Exactly. The Russians should actually put their weight on this so they can actually get the Iranians to have a middle ground through which they abide by the main request, I'm not going to say of the United States, because it's actually the request of the whole world almost, which is the fact that we don't want this revolutionary behaviors to continue.
Let me ask you.
Potential nuclear bomb by Iran. Yeah.
Let me ask you one final question, and we're down to like a minute and a half before we run out of time. But I'm, you know, there's a lot of people all over the world who want the answer to this question.
Sure.
How long does this war have to continue before we really see a serious problem with production out of the Saudi Arabia and with the price of oil truly spiking beyond $100 a barrel and maybe way beyond that? How long can you hold? Can we hold out with the Gulf of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz being shut down, for example?
That's a great question. I'm going to be very brief. Actually, the prices went to 117 already yesterday, or the day before yesterday.
And then they dropped back down, thank God.
Exactly. And they dropped down because of the three measures Saudi Arabia has taken, which I mentioned.
Yes.
But the second tool that the Saudis used to lower the prices were mostly related to the energy reservoirs we have in different countries around the world.
Right.
And the Saudis have said, or like I've kind of seen some reports that talk about the Saudis have this for the next 36 days. So we can actually provide and to have oil supply for the next 36 days from these countries. But definitely, we have also the petrol line that actually goes through the Red Sea, and we can export more than 5.5 million barrels instead of 7 million barrels. So when it comes to Saudi, things are okay.
Yep.
We can actually export because we had this contingency plan. But when it comes to other countries, like in the Gulf, like, for example, Qatar. Which is the second largest gas LNG exporter or producer in the world, has completely shut down their system because they couldn't, because Iran was actually...
So let's do this. Let's do this. 37 days from now, you and I are going to meet again. Maybe I'll come to Riyadh, because hopefully there'll be peace at that point, and we'll have this discussion again. And we'll be able to see a settled global oil market. And if not, then I've got some other tough questions for what's going to happen
next. I know. And as I said, there are a lot of things at stake. It's not only the oil. It's the food security. It's the trade security. It's so many different things. What happens in the Gulf doesn't stay in the Gulf. We should always remember that.
You are such a delight to talk to. I feel like it's so easy going back and forth with you. And Salman Al-Ansari, what a pleasure. Let's continue the relationship, and hopefully next time we'll be, you know, having some tea in Riyadh, okay?
Absolutely. And coffee. Saudi coffee is the best.
Okay. You're like me. Now you're talking like an American. we'll see you next time. Thanks so much. God bless. See you later. All right. So now to your comments. The vast majority of you were very complimentary of Scott Ritter yesterday when I had my interview with him for, he's an honest guy. And some of the things he said regarding the war in Iran, just like you hear different opinions here when we were talking to Ansari, who's also a very transparent guy, it seems to me. So here's what you said, right? Kirill Mazurek says 170 schoolgirls burned alive. This is the downfall of the USA. Shame on America. It makes me cry. John O says, just started watching Sanchez on RT. It's been such a breath of fresh air to see a program that asks the real questions that matter. Really? Oh, thank you. Namaste. Vicente Palacios says, thank you, Scott Ritter, for your emotional reaction to those innocent girls being murdered by U.S. bombs. Thank you, Rick Sanchez, for your honest and fact-finding journalism. Your leaving CNN was the greatest blessing for those of us seeking the truth. Well, let me tell you, it was a little tough for me at the time, making ends meet and trying to feed my family. Being fired is never fun. Faith Hacker 7567 says, Sanchez was owned by news propaganda in Florida for many years. He wants you to know this. I'm a bad guy. And they passed laws protecting Israel while I was there. Don't believe Rick Sanchez, he says. He's as honest as the weather forecasters in Miami. Namaste to you as well. Anders Holmgren says, Rick asks really interesting... See, here's a good one. Asks really interesting and intelligent questions in comparison with other news channels. One guy hates me, one guy loves me. David Malcolm Curry says, no, Scott, we are not all murderers led by a psychopath. Most of us do not follow that psycho. There you go. your comments. As usual, we appreciate all of the feedback. Check out my pages in different places. I'll tell you where I am. I am now on BitChute. Go check me out on BitChute.com. Go to YouTube. You'll find me there. Go to X. You'll find me there in a very big way. And if you want to listen and take a jog with me and this whole entire show every day, you can find it on Spotify. I love jogging with podcasts, by the way. That's it for me. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank our staff. And most of all, thank you for letting us into your homes. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.